And welcome to another episode of Nights at the Roundtable. Tis your boy Manuel. I got in LA, Brandon B. Real. And what's joining up, us from St. Joe, Missouri, Brian Zahn. We are so stoked to have you on. This is one of those Hail Marys, Brian. We're not going to lie. Because we're like, we've been doing this for 3 or 4 years. And obviously, like, our topic matter is they would call us a deconstruction podcast. But, you know, we, at the initial, we just had these conversations around our house where we would just drink wine and have these endless conversations.
That's called a symposium.
There you go.
That's a symposium when you drink wine and have philosophical conversations.
Is it really?
Yeah, that's what that means.
Wow. So we are fancier than we
thought. If there's no wine, it's not a symposium. And there's no wine, this is not a symposium.
Then it's a conference. We were having symposiums at my house, and we started building from there. And this season, we started thinking, man, let's just try to get people that we really want to get on. So we've shot out, like, our assistant has shot out some messages trying to get people on. And so when we found out that you agreed to come on, so stoked, because genuinely, like, B turned me on to you. He's been a fan for a while, and he turned me on to you in the first book I read, like I was telling you before we got on, was the Postcards from Babylon. And it rocked me, man. So we're like ecstatic to have you on, and ecstatic for our community to get a hold of everything that's inside your mind. So thank you for coming on.
My privilege. I'm happy to be here.
I love it. B.
Awesome.
Let's get into it.
Awesome. I feel like I have to kind of give you some flower, give you your roses, Brian, because you've had such an impact on my life personally. And I shared earlier how one of my best friends, William Matthews, back in 2013 was like, hey, there's this guy I think you really need to listen to. And he's been very aware of kind of where I've been at in my faith journey. I came from a very charismatic space, was like, you know, once I got revivalist and was speaking and traveling and all of that. And he started turning me on to your writing, and it was like a different voice. Like, it was like something just shook me. And first it was your book, Beauty Will Save the World. Very soon after that, it was all of your other books, A Fair Word to Mars, Radical Forgiveness, and then come along in 2016, Water to Wine. I'm reading this story, and there's this point where you talk about how your faith had lost its magic. Mm-hmm. And that was like, it was like the Holy Spirit came and just shook me. And at that time, I was working at a mega church, and I was on staff there. And I'm looking at my desk at this reading, and I'm weeping because I feel like this is calling me to a faith that I don't have, that I used to have. And it kind of started this like deconstruction journey for myself. And so your writings, your teachings, all of that has very been super influential in my life. And I just want to thank you so much for all of that. And so having you on today is a huge honor, and that's an understatement, right? And so, I just want to say
that's so very kind of you. Thank you. I'm sitting at my writing desk. You know, that's also where I do these podcasts, but this is my writing desk, and you just inspire me to keep writing. I feel like I just need to write right now. Now it's actually touching some people.
You are working on a new project. Can you share a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, well, I have finished manuscript. It's all done. It's all done. It's called The Wood Between the Worlds, and it's a book on the cross. You see how that worked? The Wood Between the Worlds.
Yes.
And it's 20 chapters. The subtitle is, what is the subtitle? Because I don't give the subtitle. A Poetic Theology of the Cross. That's what it is. And it's 20. One of the problems we have is when we want to make the cross mean one thing.
Right.
The cross means many, many things. And it's like looking through a kaleidoscope. And you see certain geometric designs and colors, but then you turn it a click and, oh, there's another way that we see these colors and the geometric shapes. And so this is like a kaleidoscopic view of the cross that is somewhat, maybe I'm taking more of a poetic approach to it. So that book comes out in February. I don't know exactly. I don't have a release date, but I know it's February. So it's a ways off. And the book I'm writing right now is, it's really a memoir, and it's like Watered Wine, but bigger and covers much more time. And this is called With Music in My Ears.
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah. Outside, the light was shining on the river of tears. I watched it from the distance with the music in my ears. And so that's where that's coming from. Because I've gone through life, you know, I'm a music. I mean, I guess most people say they love music. You know, if someone says, I don't really like music, I probably wouldn't be friends with that person. But I'd be kind, but probably not want to hang out. So it's not a book about music. It's about my story, but the music has always been there.
Yeah. See, in rap world, we would, what you just did, we would say bars. That was, that was bars there. Yeah. It's interesting. So this idea of the cross, because it's just so happens I'm on chapter two of Postcards, and you were talking about the cross a lot in that chapter, about how it was an idea of shame mainly back in the old world. So is it, like, do you find like the cross being misused from the church? Because when I was listening to the chapter, I'm like, dang, this is a thing of shame. Like, at what point did it become something that we wanted to slap on every building and every shirt and every jewelry? Like,
well, this is part of the story. This is how amazing it is. So, and this comes from Beauty Will Save the World that we mentioned a little bit earlier. But there was a point in my life when I thought, well, I see artistic depictions of Jesus Christ's crucifixion that are beautiful. I mean, they are artistically beautiful.
Right.
I mean, you put them in the Louvre and they are beautiful. Mm-hmm. But I protested. I said, well, it wasn't like that. I mean, I promise you, the Romans weren't trying to create art.
Right. Yeah.
crucifixion was so horrible that you wouldn't even use the word in polite company. Mm. They were not trying to do art. They were trying to terrorize an occupied people. Just don't even think about rebelling, because this is what will happen to you. That's the message of crucifixion. So there was a time when I thought, well, I don't know if this is right. I mean, it was just part of maybe being Protestant.
Sure.
But then I realized, no, the fault is mine. If we had, say, a journalistic photograph of the events at Golgotha on Good Friday, circa AD 30 or whenever, we might look at it once, regret that we had, and never look at it again, because it would be horrifying. It would be repellent. It would be ugly. Mm. And yet then you have someone comes along it's been depicted millions and millions of times in terms of beauty. Well, okay. The role of the artist is not that of the journalist. The journalist is simply to tell us the facts. The role of the artist is to alert us to what we may have overlooked. Mm. So think of Van Gogh, and think of his most famous painting would be Starry Night. Most people would be familiar with that, with those swirls of stars and all that. Well, is that a journalistic, realistic depiction of what you would see on a starry night? No. I mean, you go out on a starry night and look up, you don't see what is represented in Van Gogh's Starry Night. But Van Gogh isn't trying to just a one-to-one depiction of what you would see. He's saying, wake up, pay attention.
Right.
There's wonder and majesty and beauty all around you. What you see on the canvas of Van Gogh's Starry Night is what you should feel in your soul when you are drawn into the wonder of a starry night. Mm. Well, what the artists depicting Christ crucified in terms of beauty are doing is they're saying, oh yeah, we know that this was a lynching, this was a murder, this was the greatest crime of all, this was ugly, this was horrific, but that is not all that was happening there. Because there is, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. There is, in fact, the beauty of love and mercy and saving grace present there. And so I think we've done the right thing in depicting the crucifixion in terms of beauty, as long as we don't forget,
right,
the accuracy, also reality,
right.
You know, the cross was not a Christian symbol until mid 4th century, which is to say, as long as crucifixion was still being employed. That was just a little bit too jarring. The sign of the cross comes late 1st century, and they sang about the cross, and they spoke of the cross. They didn't depict it until crucifixion was no longer a practice within the Roman Empire. So I understand what you're saying, but no, I I'm sitting right here. I've got my Orthodox cross icon. Of course, you know, it tells the whole story of Jesus from his condemnation all the way to his resurrection's down here. It's beautiful, right? This presides over my my right. This, like I said, I'm at my right hand desk, and every book I've written, I have a candle in front of this icon. Because I want the cross of Christ to preside over everything I write. But that's it's beautiful, right? But I think it's a good thing. I understand the ugliness of human sin, the ugliness of empire, the ugliness of a absolute commitment to power. All of that is present, you know, in the act of crucifixion. But it's also divine love. It's Father, forgive them. It's Christ with his arms outstretched in proffered embrace, saying, Father, forgive them. And as long as we're on this subject, let me just say, and the response of the Father is, of course, Son. This is who we are. The Son, we're into theology. The Son never acts as an agent of change upon the Father. The Father is immutable. The Son reveals the Father. In other words, The cross is not where Jesus saves us from God, to put it very crudely. The cross is where Jesus reveals God as Savior. Amen. All right, so I won't.
That's so good. I think you even write about it in Beauty Who Saved the World. What you were just saying kind of sparked that of, here we have in the first time in human history, instead of somebody taking the life of another, or, you know, having that bloodshed, he now lays down his own life, right? His own blood is shed. And so it shows us a whole new way to be human. But it's interesting of how that message of love, forgiveness, all of that, but also including nonviolence, right? Which is the message of Jesus and what he has shown in his life and his ways. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know we're obviously living in a time where, Americans, very much so, they are committed and devoted to their guns and their Second Amendment.
Lord, have mercy.
And we have Christians who, you know, are trying to follow the way of Jesus. And so this whole thing of nonviolence and Second Amendment and American Christianity and all this thing could get very jumbled. Would love you to speak into that.
I think the whole gun thing is America at its weirdest.
Yeah.
Or just about anyway. It's the thing above all things that people outside of America find incomprehensible. You know, I travel regularly and widely around the world, and that's the thing that Christians in other nations that would share much in common with the general evangelical milieu in the United States finds incomprehensible about America, and that is the devotion to guns. Now, before I say anything more, I don't have any problem. I'm not a hunter, but I'm not against it. You know, right. I'm not a vegetarian, right?
Right.
And so, I have nothing against hunting. But this thing about, you know, we've reached the point where you need to carry an assault rifle into Walmart. You know, what is this? What has happened to us? And I think it's the myth of redemptive violence, which is very central to the American myth. It's a, you know, jumping the shark. It's become bizarre, where our legislatures seem incapable of passing any common sense legislation. And I was in New Zealand. I was just walking down the street, and I heard there were these two women behind me, and they were having a conversation, and overheard them. And one of them said, you know, I'd like to visit America, but I'd probably get shot, chucked into a river and never heard of again. I mean, this is kind of the
wow
of the view that the rest of the developed world has of us.
Yeah. Wow.
And as we connect it to Christians, I just don't. Well, here's something. First of all, the Second Amendment. I don't care what the Second Amendment. What's the Second Amendment? It's a revision to a constitution, you know, that's 250 plus years old. I mean, what is it? Who cares?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it's not sacred, you know, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I think it has something to do with state militias, you know, a well-regulated militia. I get, you know, and so they need to keep their little musket that they can fire like every 10 minutes in the corner of their, you know, log cabin. I think that's what was the intent behind
it. Yeah, that was the original intent.
Poorly worded. They probably should have thought it through, but they never imagined that the kind of weaponry that we have today. First of all, they didn't imagine that. And secondly, that every Tom, Dick, and Harry could go anywhere they want with it. Okay, so you can tell where I'm coming from on this. And by the way, this does not represent, you know, some people know part of my story and they know, you know, a theological shift and all that. So my water to wine journey, we can talk about that if you like, but this does not belong to that. I have been going on about this since I was a teenager. I've just always thought America has been ridiculous in its devotion to the gun.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not for just completely disarming the entire populace. There's a role for firearms, but people just wanting to carry guns everywhere they go all the time, that's not healthy. That's not normal. That doesn't bespeak a healthy society. And why would Christians be that? Of course, they do that, you know, that Jesus armed the disciples, you know, on the night of his betrayal, which it tells you why, so that he would be numbered among the transgressors. Jesus has to, it's sort of set up. And they have the swords, and then when they try to use them, Jesus, no, we're not going to use them. Put it away. Tertullian, the church father, said, when Christ disarmed Peter, he disarmed all Christians.
Wow.
We are not those that go through the world prioritizing self-defense. See, self-defense is sacred in the American psyche. It's not in Christian ethics. I mean, we're not seeking martyrdom, but we as Christians are supposed to be those that would rather lay down our life than take a life. I mean, I know that sounds almost offensive, and people are ready to fight me, and yet this is how the church talked for the first 300 years of its existence. It wasn't controversial. I mean, if you wanted to become a Christian prior to Constantine and you were in the Roman legions, you're in the army, you could. They would accept soldiers because, like in America today, the military in the Roman Empire was just pervasive. They did everything. They didn't just fight the wars. They were something of the police force. They built the roads. They were the engineers, the bridges, all of that sort of thing. So you were not required to leave the military upon baptism, but you had to take a vow that you would not kill, even in battle, even in war.
Wow.
So to be a Christian in the first 300 years, you had to say, no, I take a vow that I will not kill. So America has no respect for martyrdom. We don't know the stories of the martyrs. I mean, some Catholics do a little bit, but outside of the Catholic world, we don't know their stories, and we have made a fetish of the gun. We've turned it almost into a sacrament.
Wow.
And I see it in Christian churches. You know, you see a church having some event, they're going to give away an AR-15. I'm probably getting in trouble here, but I think that just verges almost on the demonic. I mean, it just seems demonic to me.
Yeah.
It's definitely not like I feel like I fell victim to that initially, because there was something about righteous anger, right? If somebody did something to us that was just wrong, there was something in me that justified, oh, this is a righteous anger. This is like, we should get him back. So anytime America was like, oh, you hit us, we're going to hit you back. I can admit there was a low-key pride in that as an American, that we're the quote-unquote biggest bully on the yard. And there's just something about like, yeah, don't mess with us or we'll get you type of thing. And as I continue to understand Christianity, which is funny because I've wanted to buy a gun to protect my house, but I haven't pulled the trigger yet. Sorry for the pun, but I haven't done it.
And you walked right into that.
Yeah.
Because literally when people ask me, well, what would you do? And I'll be like, you know, I would get one just so I can shoot it in the air and hopefully scare them. I don't want to shoot them. I just want to be like, bang, bang, shoot my roof. I got a gun. Be scared. Go away. But I can't in my heart be like, man, I don't know if I could take a life. So maybe.
So I don't own a gun out of, because I don't hunt. Right. You know, so I tell people, I say, I own an ice axe. Do you own an ice axe? No. Why? You're not a mountain climber. Right. Okay. So you don't own, I don't hunt. So I don't own a gun. I wouldn't think in terms of trying, you know, maybe I live in a more peaceful community. I don't know. Although maybe not. I don't own a gun cause I don't want to shoot anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. And people say, well, could you imagine a scenario where you wish you had a gun? I said, yeah, I probably could. But can you imagine a scenario where you wish you didn't have a gun? And my imagined scenario is a whole lot more common than yours. I mean, all the statistics are there. A gun in the house makes you less safe. I mean, the statistics are there. Mm-hmm. You're not more safe. You're less safe. Okay, whatever. I don't want to have really any other cause other than I just want to help people see Jesus, be fascinated by Jesus, follow Jesus. So I'm not going to just harp on and on about something that people are so divided and opinionated about. So because I don't think I'm going to change anybody's mind probably at this point.
Yeah,
Sure. If they got it, they got it. It's funny because just now when you'd mentioned a church event having a sort of raffle to give away an assault rifle, when you said that, it was almost like I could visualize that church, right? And that church probably has a huge American flag somewhere in the sanctuary.
Of course.
Which is weird, right? But it feeds into their the narrative that they play in their head that, you know, America has and will continue to be a Christian nation. And obviously, we know that that is a myth. And I'd love for you to share a little bit on that of America being a Christian nation. You said something that was, I forgot which, but you said, hey, America can never be a Christian nation.
Well, no.
Well, it was in the postcards, right? You were talking about that any people that's so connected with empire, that's not counter to the empire, is kind of like impossible to like live the way of Christ when we're so empire move, like we're so in bed with the empire.
Yeah. So let's slow down here. Slow down. And let's, because we're throwing around the word empire, and I want to unpack that a little bit.
Okay.
America is a behemoth. It is so big. Mm-hmm. It strides the world stage unlike any other nation. It is so big that America is not one thing, it is four things. It is a nation, a culture, an empire, and a religion. Okay, so let's back up here. Let's look at these. Of course, America is a nation, right? I mean, with its 50 states and borders and laws, yeah, we get that. And it is a culture because I travel the world and I never leave America. You know, the U2 song, outside it's America. And you know, everywhere I go, I find a McDonald's and a Starbucks and a KFC and, you know, all of that. And right. not just, you know, the chain restaurants and all that, but just, you know, America still drives the cultural agenda, at least of the West. And I don't know, I've traveled pretty much in the East too. And I would say it drives the cultural agenda of the world. Yeah. So America is two things to begin with. It's a nation and a culture. And as such, America's a mixed bag, but there is much that is admirable. There is much that is worthy of celebration and emulation. There is a unique entrepreneurial energy in America that maybe we're just so familiar with, we don't realize how unusual it is. That this is one of the good things that people outside of America say about us. So you guys have, you know, you're ready to do something new, and you have imagination, and you just have energy to say, well, no, we can do it differently and do it better, and we can improve it. And so these are some of the things that are admirable about America. When we talk about the advances that America has led the world in terms of science, medicine, art, all kinds of things that are admirable, but it's a mixed bag. We know that. Mm. But then we move to empire. America is an empire. Now, what do I mean by that? Do I just mean like a big fancy nation? Well, no, I mean empires are rich, powerful nations who at their core actually believe, somehow they believe, they have a right, perhaps usually it's a divine right, mm-hmm. to rule the world, to rule other nations, and to shape history according to their agenda. Now, as we read scripture, God seems to delight in nations with their diversity of ethnicity and language and culture, etc. You know, God created the fish of the sea, you know, and he didn't just create one fish. What are they all? You know, there's, you know. So God seems to like this about nations, but God is opposed to empire. That is, rich, powerful nations who believe they have a divine right to rule other nations and a manifest destiny to shape history according to their agenda, because this, in fact, is the very thing that God has promised to his son. Jesus is the one who has a right to rule the nations, mm-hmm. and Jesus is the one that has a right to shape history according to a divine agenda. And the Bible, unless we've learned how to screen it out, and we probably have, but the Bible maintains a critique of empire throughout the entire book. It's present in Genesis, is really clear in Exodus. It shows up in the Hebrew prophets. You see it, you know, scattered throughout the New Testament, and the book of Revelation is ultimately a prophetic critique of empire. Mm. Because, and then that moves us into the fourth thing, and America is a religion. That's the one that some people may be offended by, but come on. It has all, can you really argue with it? America is a religion complete with founding myths, holy days, sacred sites, sacred ceremonies, sacred texts, right? I mean, I meet people all the time, Christians, who actually think somehow the U.S. Constitution or something is on par with the inspiration of scriptures or some nonsense like that, complete with liturgical gesture.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, you do this or this. And if you don't do this at the right time, people are like, whoa, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
If you go to the U.S. Capitol and you go and you look up, you go into the rotunda and you look up at the dome, what you will see is the apotheosis of George Washington. That's the name of the mural, I guess you would call it, that's on the dome of the Capitol. And what it is, I mean, look it up if you doubt me. It is a depiction of George Washington having ascended to heaven and is seated upon a throne surrounded by other gods, the god Victory and maybe Liberty. I think it's Victory and Liberty. Wow. That are depicted as goddesses, but they're the goddess Victory and the goddess Liberty and George wow. Washington. Apotheosis, Greek, that's a Greek to make a god of, to become god. It's
wow.
If we use the Latin derivative, it would be the deification mm-hmm. of George Washington. This is religious, my friends.
Yeah.
And so this is one of the things that really began to alarm me 20 years ago mm-hmm. is when I realized that the Christianity I knew was too consumerist, too mm-hmm. shallow, too thin, and way too American. The reason we have a hard time understanding Americanism as a religion is because it's so conflated with Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Americanism, the religion, borrows heavily from Christian language and text and tradition. And so we imagine that they can be the same thing or more or less the same thing. And that's where, that's why we come up with this language of a Christian nation and right. that sort of stuff. Look, there is a Christian nation. It's called the church. It's called the church, and it's comprised of the baptized, and Jesus is Lord. But the church doesn't have armies.
Yeah.
And the church doesn't try to rule the world. Hmm. The church confesses that Jesus Christ is Lord, and we live under his reign and rule. And if our constitution is the Sermon on the Mount, and you can't wage war and live the Sermon on the Mount. You have to choose which you're going to do.
Yeah.
You can't do both. Christendom was the attempt to do both. And what happened was, you know, in the early part of the fourth century, you end up with a Christian emperor. I mean, Constantine, his father was a pagan. His mother was apparently a very sincere Christian, Helena. I think she was a real believer. And then there's this episode where, as the hagiography goes, that Constantine sees a vision on the eve of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. There was a civil war, two generals trying to become emperor, Maxentius and Constantine. And as it's told, I think this is all legend. I don't think there's any reality to it. But the story is that Constantine sees this cross in the heavens, and with these words, "In this sign you shall conquer." And then the sign of the cross is applied to the shields and weaponry of the armies of Constantine. They win the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. He goes on and becomes emperor. Well, first of all, "in this sign you shall conquer." Recognize that in that context, conquer is a euphemism for kill.
Right.
So in this sign you shall kill, because I want to be emperor instead of that other general. So then you have this. So now you have and Constantine becomes a kind of Christian, although he delays his baptism until he's on his deathbed, which was not a Christian practice.
Right.
I think Constantine kind of understood, you know what? I don't think you can really be a Christian and emperor at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I'll just wait till I'm not emperor anymore, or, you know, I've come to the end of the line. Now I want to say something though, that the church in general celebrated this and embraced the idea that now we are going to have a Christian empire. That was a mistake. It's clearly a mistake, but it was probably an inevitable mistake. I just can't imagine there's some Christian in Milan in the year 312, just following the great persecution of Diocletian, an emperor who viciously persecuted Christians, hearing that, you know, the new emperor is some kind of Christian, and they're going to say, well, we're not going to put up with that, are we?
Right.
I mean, I think they're going to hear it. I think it's inevitable that they hear it as something positive. But it's mm-hmm. only as we understand history that it puts us on a trajectory
right.
that leads to the great two world wars in Europe, where in the name of national allegiance, Christians are killing Christians by the millions.
Thanks so much, y'all, for listening to part one of this episode. We appreciate it greatly. Hey, like and subscribe if you guys are feeling this. Share it with your friends. We appreciate it so much. Please come back next week for part two. Love you.